It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, reaction to and implications of the Israeli Prime Minister's controversial speech to a joint meeting of U.S. Congress about Iran's nuclear program. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. It wasn't so much what he said, although critics take issue with some of his remarks, but how, when, and where he said it. On Tuesday, March 3rd, just 2 weeks before Israeli elections, in which Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is seeking a fourth term, he addressed U.S. lawmakers about what he considers are the perils of current negotiations by the United States and five other world powers with Iran over how to curb its nuclear program. Netanyahu's speech had been at the center of a bitter dispute with the White House, which was furious that the speech was arranged in conjunction with House Speaker John Boehner, without either the speaker or anyone from Netanyahu's office first reaching out to the administration. As a result, neither President Barack Obama nor any of his senior aides met with the Israeli Prime Minister, and last week, National Security Advisor Susan Rice said his speech would be destructive to U.S.-Israel ties and had injected a degree of partisanship into the relationship. The speech escalated Netanyahu's campaign against President Obama's Iran diplomacy, putting unprecedented stress on the two leaders' already strained ties, not to mention the U.S.-Israel relationship. More than 50 Democratic senators and members of Congress, including six Jewish lawmakers, boycotted the speech, and several who attended looked visibly angry during portions of the remarks. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said the speech was condescending and an insult to the intelligence of the United States. President Obama, for his part, said the remarks contained, quote, nothing new and offered no viable alternatives to the current nuclear talks. Nonetheless, known for his powerful delivery and rhetoric, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made a strong case against the emerging deal, which he thinks doesn't block Iran's path to the bomb, but rather paves Iran's path to it. He also said that Iran's regime was as radical as ever and could not be trusted. The deal among Iran and six world powers would curtail a program the West has long suspected is aimed at building weapons, but would not completely dismantle it, as Netanyahu is advocating. The United States and European allies argue that such an agreement would be a diplomatic triumph because it would bring Iran's program out of the shadows and under a tighter process of UN verification and monitoring. U.S. officials say that Iran would never agree to completely abandon a nuclear fuel capacity. It considers a point of national pride from the days of the Shah to the current Islamic Republic. With Netanyahu's remarks to Congress, some analysts say the future of U.S.-Israeli relations and Iran's nuclear program hang on the line. And just as his speech polarized official Washington, it also divided Israeli voters, who will decide in 2 weeks whether to elect Benjamin Netanyahu for a fourth term. The deadline for the P5+1 to reach an agreement with Iran over its nuclear program is March 24th. Well, for more on the implications this event could have for the future of U.S.-Israeli relations, negotiations with Iran, and overall U.S. policy in the Middle East, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts. Natan Sachs is a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and that's a centrist policy group here in Washington. Natan is currently writing a book on Israeli grand strategy. And James Phillips, he's senior fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a conservative think tank here in Washington. And James has been writing about the Middle East and international terrorism for more than 30 years. And both gentlemen join us by phone. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
Well, Natan Sachs, let me begin with you. And Let's set aside for a minute the substance of Benjamin Netanyahu's address to Congress. Critics of the speech say that arranging it through congressional Republicans without coordinating or notifying the administration in advance and scheduling it 2 weeks before Israeli elections, that the prime minister injected partisanship into his visit. He both, on the one hand, disrespected the White House, it was a breach of protocol, and also turned what has always been a strong bipartisan issue, the U.S.-Israeli relationship, into a more partisan one. What do you make of this criticism?
I think there's a lot to it. I think the substance of the speech is not to be dismissed offhand. There's an important argument to be made against haste in negotiations with the Iranians. But the way to do it is not this. What the prime minister did was to come to Washington with a breach of protocol, in a sense, not informing the administration. But more importantly, he came to Washington to advocate passionately for something he believes genuinely, which is completely opposed to the policy of the president. Now, there's nothing wrong with that in theory, but doing that in such a setting in the U.S. Capitol is a different story. And it's especially important because, as you mentioned, there's a long-term issue of U.S.-Israeli relations. Israel, for a very long time, has relied on bipartisan support. It's one of the central tenets of Israeli diplomacy in the United States and of Israeli supporters in the United States. The party traditionally, the pro-Israel party, the party of Harry Truman, who recognized Israel 11 minutes after it was declared, is a Democratic party. And in recent years, the Republican Party has been at least as supportive of Israel. Now, suddenly, we see the Prime Minister of Israel siding very clearly with a Republican leadership in Congress against a Democratic president. And that's done two things. First, it's rallied some of the Democratic legislators around the president in opposition to the Prime Minister's point of view. It's weakened the possibility of legislation that Israel itself was hoping would pass in Congress, because now senators, in particular from the Democratic Party, are loath to go against the Democratic president. Is then a second thing. It signaled to younger Democrats that their leadership is in a dramatic opposition to Israel, something that was never true in the past. Nancy Pelosi may not be popular on the right, but she is very popular among many Democrats. And the president, again, unpopular on the right, but very popular among young Democrats. They campaigned for him, many of them. They're now seeing the prime minister opposing him very publicly and snubbing him, in a sense. The fact that the vice president was not behind the prime minister, it was the president pro tempore of the Senate, instead of the vice president standing behind them, speaks volumes. In this sense, it has real diplomatic damage, irrespective of the Iran issue, which is, of course, more important in some regards, but this is a very serious issue. Finally, on the Israeli politics, that's an added kink. Israel is going to elections in 2 weeks. The prime minister is seen by Israelis, in fact, a majority of Israelis, as having organized this for political reasons. I tend to think there was also a substantive reason for it, but many Israelis think this was politics. And, of course, I think it does help him, although only marginally.
Turning to you, James Phillips, for your reaction to particularly the invitation itself, the fact that it looks like partisanship was injected into the visit, both on the part of the Republican leadership of the House of Representatives who invited Benjamin Netanyahu, and also on the part of Netanyahu himself, who apparently would like to bolster his chances of reelection at home.
To paraphrase Claude Rains' movie Casablanca, I'm shocked that partisanship entered the hall of U.S. Congress. You know, I think there was a sense of tit for tat, perhaps on Speaker Boehner's part, because he's been very critical of the administration for unilateral steps on different issues, including immigration. And the administration used British Prime Minister David Cameron to lobby Congress for the deal. And I think this invitation to Prime Minister Netanyahu may have in part been a reaction to that. But I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu did rise above petty politics, and he went out of his way early in the speech to praise President Obama for his close cooperation and support for Israel. So I think there, Prime Minister Netanyahu diffused to some extent this charge of mere partisan politics. And I think the way he framed the speech in moral terms transcended politics and really resonated among a broad American audience, particularly those that haven't been closely following the negotiations. I'm not sure that the speech in and of itself will demonstrably move U.S. Congress, but I think he did raise concrete questions the administration needs to answer if it hopes to get congressional support for what is emerging as a very controversial deal with Iran.
Very well. Well, we'll get into some of those legitimate questions in just a moment. But first, back to you, Nathan Sachs, with regard to some of the content of the speech and particularly the objectives of Benjamin Netanyahu. Do you think he wants to sink this impending deal, modify it, energize Congress to either sink it or delay it? Or does he want to look like a bold, powerful leader vis-a-vis the Israeli electorate just before the elections to win votes, or all of the above? What do you think his objectives were, and to what extent did he achieve them?
Well, cynics in Israel would say that he was hoping to use his best skill, which is speaking in English, very good English, and very good oratory, about Israeli security. That's what launched his career. He was ambassador to the United Nations for Israel and a very successful one. But I think he genuinely is very deeply concerned about this deal that's proposed. We actually don't know that it will be signed. And in that sense, he is trying to break that deal, trying to prevent it from coming. It's very clear what his objective is, and it's dramatically opposed to that of the president. And in that regard, he's not hiding it. He's hoping to break these talks up. It's not just a modification. It's a dramatically different approach. Netanyahu suggested many different issues with the deal, which we can discuss later, but perhaps the weakness of the Israeli position for a long time, at least in the PR sense, has been convincing the American public and the president that there is a viable alternative, that they are not just criticizing what is a bad deal, but suggesting that there is something else that is better. Because after all, Iran is already close to being a threshold state, and in that regard, all options are very bad. Netanyahu tried to outline something like that, and he stated very clearly that he has a practical alternative, which is a better deal. It's a very hard sell to convince how a dramatically better deal could be done, although I think a better deal might have been done if negotiations were done more carefully or in a more tough way. But what the Israelis are also suggesting is that a bad deal, according to Netanyahu, this one is a bad deal, is worse than no deal at all. And in no deal at all, what they're calling on is for deterrence, in a sense, deterrence of Iran, preventing it from crossing the threshold through the threat of the use of force and more sanctions. And in that regard, that's a very hard sell, in part because that means perhaps living with a threshold Iran for quite a while, something that Israel has been warning about for a long time. And second, it would require the kind of vigilance and the credible threat of force. In other words, convincing Americans, but especially the Iranians, that the American people, the American government is willing to go to war over this. And that is a hard sell. It doesn't mean that Israel is advocating war. Some people claim that. In fact, what Israel is saying is that war needs to be threatened, and that the more credible the threat, the less the chance of war. But, of course, it does mean risking that possibility. And that's not an easy sell. It's something that the prime minister was trying to do.
Indeed. Well, and others also say that this type of approach, notwithstanding its merits, would be difficult to maintain vis-a-vis the other negotiating partners, the Europeans.
Exactly. I think this is a crucial point. The question is not just what the Americans are doing, but the sanctions. Some of them are mostly unilateral, American and European, in particular the financial sanctions. But other sanctions depend dramatically on the cooperation of other partners. For example, the sale of oil, which is, of course, the central revenue source for Iran, that depends on consumers of oil, in particular China and other major consumers. For them to be together in the deal, it's crucial for the Americans to convince the world that it is Iran at fault that there is no deal. One of the major dangers with this speech, to my mind, but in general with this approach, is that, in a sense, the Republicans in Congress and the Prime Minister risk volunteering to take blame if the deal does not happen. If it does, you can see the logic of making this speech, trying to stave off what he thinks is a disaster. But there's a chance there is no deal, and then it might be blamed on America or even worse, on Israel, instead of the one that actually is to blame, the one that has been intransigent in these talks, and that's the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Turning to you, James Phillips, for your take on the content of the speech, the objectives of Benjamin Netanyahu, and to what extent he achieved them.
Well, I think he achieved in raising the bar for the coming congressional debate over the proposed deal. As the contours of the deal become more visible, I think there is a growing nervousness on both sides of the aisle, both Republican and Democrat, about many of the points he brought up. The fact that Iran, it looks like, is not going to be required to dismantle its extensive nuclear infrastructure. The fact that the administration is walking away from six UN Security Council resolutions that called for a complete halt in uranium enrichment. And the fact that the deal will sunset at some point, either 10 to 15 years away, it's not clear when, and that after that, Iran will be treated as just another country, despite its long history of cheating on its nuclear proliferation commitments. So in that sense, I think the Prime Minister did plant seeds that will sprout in the U.S. Congress in the coming debate. But whether that is enough to halt a deal, I think remains unclear and is probably not going to be done if the administration can present a strong enough case when the deal, in fact, is announced.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Nathan Sachs. He's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, a Washington-based policy group, and James Phillips, from whom you just heard. He's senior fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation, a think tank also here in Washington. And I'm Carol Castiel. We're discussing the political fallout from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent address on Iran to a joint meeting of Congress. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can also send feedback via email to encounter@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a faithful listener and proud father of twins from Port Harcourt, Nigeria, Johnson Okwu Kamalu. Well, let me turn back to you, Nathan Sachs, to continue our conversation about the speech that Benjamin Netanyahu gave to a joint meeting of Congress with respect to Iran talks. First of all, I'd like to get your reaction to, or rather, Israel's reaction. I know you have your pulse on Israeli public opinion. How did they react to this? Is it going to move the dial for him on the elections, or is the Iran deal, no matter how important it is, not figuring as highly as other issues in the campaign? How was it received back home?
It's a mixed bag. On the one hand, the speech itself was powerful. It was well-crafted, well-delivered, something that Netanyahu was very good at. And moreover, most Israelis are extremely concerned about Iran. They're much closer to Netanyahu's point of view than the president, for example. And moreover, they have less information than the leaders do. We all have less information than they do. And of course, they tend to trust their conservative leader, since they are extremely fearful of the possibility of a nuclear Iran that time and again threatens at least the Israeli regime, it says, perhaps not the people themselves. That's very little comfort for Israeli citizens. That said, there are many other issues that are extremely important for the Israeli voters. Domestic issues, the cost of living, which is very high in Israel, economic downturn, a variety of different social divides inside Israel. This creates a two-sided campaign. On the one hand, on foreign policy, Iran, the Palestinians, other things, Benjamin Netanyahu holds a lead. So in that regard, Netanyahu gains from any time the conversation is turned to foreign affairs. On the other hand, the Israeli public cares dramatically about other issues. And the way some people have responded is that this Iran threat just keeps buzzing in their head, that Netanyahu keeps on harping on this issue. People spoke, for example, about quality of life and other issues, and Netanyahu quite famously recently quipped that he never forgets for a moment the sanctity of life itself in trying to prevent Iran. And this has become a bit of a mocking phrase among opponents of Netanyahu, saying that no issue can now be discussed in Israel without Netanyahu reminding the voters of Iran. In that regard, we've seen only a limited bump for Netanyahu, if any, really, in the polls. We still see a divided public. Netanyahu is certainly, to my mind, the front runner. He's likely to be prime minister again after the elections, but it's not a complete done deal. There still is a chance for the opposition leader, Isaac Herzog.
Indeed. Turning to you, James Phillips, I don't know if you have anything to add or subtract with regard to reaction in the Israeli electorate, but I'd like you to comment on one interesting item, and that is that a number of retired Israeli generals, over 150, actually warned Benjamin Netanyahu against making this speech, saying that it might cause more harm than good, that it would damage Israel's special relationship with the United States and even undermine military and intelligence ties. And rather than slowing down Iran's nuclear program, that this speech is likely to bring the Islamic Republic closer to developing a nuclear bomb. I guess coming from very senior former generals, one might want to take this relatively seriously. How do you see it?
Well, I think their concern is valid if he, in fact, damaged the relations, but I'm not sure he did damage relations. In fact, if perhaps with this administration, but it's not going to last longer than this administration. And I would defer to Nathan about the Israeli politics. I have trouble following American politics, where it's only two main parties. But in Israel, it's almost like too much democracy. There are so many moving parts. But
Let me ask you then, if you don't mind my interrupting you, to talk about impact here from your point of view on the U.S.-Israeli relationship, insofar as it has been so bipartisan thus far, and to the extent that many critics are saying that his address, the way it was done, not so much that he did it, but the way he was invited by the Republican Speaker of the House, bypassing the White House, irritating many Democratic members of Congress, many Jewish members of Congress. To what extent do you think this may have some lasting damage on this very special relationship?
Well, I think it may have done more damage to relations between Speaker Boehner and the White House than between Israel and the United States. And this is part of a broader power struggle within Washington that, you know, I think is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. But I think most Americans see Prime Minister Netanyahu as genuinely concerned about disagreement for foreign policy and existential Israeli survival reasons, not merely to use it as a means of pole vaulting into another term in office.
Back to you, Nathan Sachs. And let's get into some legitimate questions that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu raised, that both those in favor and against his appearance at the U.S. Congress felt were quite legitimate. And that is having to do with the so-called verification regime. To what extent, again, we don't know yet. The deal isn't done yet. But there are concerns over if a deal is reached, how to, you know, make sure that the international community can, in fact, monitor any violations. And then the so-called sunset provision, where Prime Minister Netanyahu criticized what may be a 10-year horizon, saying that 10 years goes in a flash and that somehow that should be modified.
Yes, I think there are some very important issues. I mean, first, we should all say we don't actually know the details of the deal. In part, the White House warned Netanyahu not to divulge details, because these details were given in confidence by the Americans to the Israelis, although since the speech was announced, there's probably a bit of a slowdown in cooperation in sharing of information, precisely because we're afraid he would share it. And that's, I think, the first sign of the damage to the relationship between the countries. But the contents themselves, there are some very important issues. The Sunset Clause is serious. 10 or 15 years is not a short time, but it's not very long either. And there's a real risk that afterwards, the Islamic Republic would be legitimized in doing a variety of different things that could only be construed seriously as pursuing nuclear weapons capability. In particular, if, and this is the second big concern, if much of the infrastructure, the enrichment infrastructure, is kept in place. Iran demanded the right to enrich, which doesn't exist legally, but they understood the NPT to say that they have a right to enrich uranium. The NPT, in fact, talks about the right to use nuclear energy or nuclear technology for peaceful purposes. But, of course, you do not need to enrich to do that. You can get enriched uranium abroad. Many countries, many advanced countries that have nuclear energy but no nuclear weapons program do exactly that, and there's no reason Iran couldn't have done the same. And this is the main reason that almost all observers outside Iran concluded that they are pursuing at least the possibility of breaking through to a weapons capability. If that remains partly intact, especially given that the deal will expire, that is a cause for concern. Of course, the main weakness for these kinds of arguments is twofold. First, what these deals, first, the interim deal, which Netanyahu objected vociferously and called an historic error, and now, in a sense, is proposing that it be maintained, and especially this kind of deal, would offer much more verification, would offer inspections that would be much more intrusive than in the past, certainly much more intrusive than under the NPT, which is what existed before the interim deal. And so if we go back to the day before these negotiations, Iran was, in a sense, a threshold state, and that is a far more dangerous position to be in. And secondly, with the restrictions that would exist in this deal, the breakthrough possibility, in theory, would be enlarged from perhaps a couple of months before these talks began to perhaps a year. That's the administration's position. But over all that remains the biggest question, which is, what is the alternative? If the alternative is no deal and a return to the status quo ante before these negotiations started, we could find an Iran that is a threshold state without the intrusive inspections of the interim deal or this final deal, and we could find ourselves in a much worse position, in a sense. So I think there are very valid concerns. I honestly cannot judge without the full details of the deal, but we cannot judge it without keeping in mind the alternative of a no deal.
Back to you, James Phillips, for your perspective on some of the, you know, legitimate concerns that Benjamin Netanyahu did bring up in his controversial address. But then again, this argument about what is the alternative, that even though the deal, we don't know, again, the outlines of it, it has yet to be actually presented, that it may be imperfect, but it's better than a race to the bomb, as Nathan Sachs said, the status quo ante, where there were no intrusive inspections and that point where Iran might be a threshold state.
I think Prime Minister Netanyahu did tap into a growing anxiety in Congress about the emerging outlines of the deal, not only the length, but there is concerns that IAEA inspectors alone would not be sufficient to maintain adequate transparency in Iran. They've already missed several programs, the one in Syria, and before the 1991 Gulf War, they were surprised by the extent of the Iraqi program. So there's growing nervousness about whether, even if you do get a good deal, that it will be able to be sufficiently monitored and verified. And I think that is likely to stick in the coming congressional debate. And the length of the deal, again, no one really is happy with, especially in view of Iran's long history of cheating on its past obligations. And it should be noted that these negotiations really have been going on a lot longer than just the last 2 years. It goes back to 2002 when the Iranian uranium enrichment facility was discovered at Natanz and another potential plutonium bomb factory was discovered at Iraq. And negotiations really have gone nowhere since then. There has been a little bit more visibility into Iran's program by stepped-up inspections under the interim accord, which is a plus. But on the other hand, Iran still hasn't come clean on its previous nuclear activities, especially what the IAEA calls possible military dimensions of its program. And it's been stonewalling on that score, and it looks like it may even go into a final agreement without clarifying those concerns. And I think that would be a major problem.
All right, gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Let's keep an eye out in the coming weeks. March 17th, of course, Israeli elections, and March 24th, the deadline for the Iran nuclear deal. A lot coming ahead of us, and we will be monitoring those very important events. I'd like to thank my guests on this edition of Encounter, Nathan Sachs. He's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and James Phillips, senior fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you, gentlemen, for your terrific insights.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Zainab Abdelrahman. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.